Welcome to Nightlife, the first hour.
It's no surprise today that almost everywhere you look, people are glued to their smartphones. How much time do we spend on them? It's probably going to get worse, with Apple apparently releasing this month a brand new updated and very latest phone too. Our obsession with social media and status updates not only keeps physiotherapists and chiropractors in business for years to come, I'm sure, but it looks like psychologists are also going to be in demand to help us fix the emotional toll that social media has on our well-being. New research from the US has tracked 5,000 Facebook users to find an increase in using the social media site has an overall negative impact on your self-reported emotional state. The results show that for every 1% increase in likes on links and status updates, users reported a 5 to 8% decrease in their mental health and well-being. So why are we so addicted to something that in the end makes us miserable? Does Facebook use in the long run make you sad? If it does, what are we going to do about it? Like all big, intrusive and life-changing technologies, Facebook has a lot of good things about it. But have we just bought the idea that connectivity is a social good? Why is it just because Mark Zuckerberg told us that it was? If you're one of the 9 million, I know, 9 million Australians who logs in every day for fear of missing out, this might be a discussion for you. Katina Michael is a professor at the School of Computing and Information Technology from the University of Wollongong. Katina is involved in many discussions about the ethical implications of technology and social media, and she joins us this evening to have a look at the topic. Katina, good evening. Welcome to Nightlife.
Thank you, Philip.
Lovely to have you in with us. Also joining us is Philippa, that's a good name, Philippa Thornton, a clinical psychologist in Sydney, who sees firsthand how technology addiction is impacting relationships and mental health. Philippa, welcome to the studio. Welcome to Nightlife.
Thank you.
Katina, the use of social media in our society is still relatively new. We don't know everything about it. We've sort of bought the idea that connectivity is great, partly because Mark Zuckerberg told us it was. And when Facebook launched, we sort of bought the idea that being connected up with other people is a good thing. We're only just beginning to learn, though, aren't we, about the social impacts of it. What's the research tell us at the moment?
Well, we're wired to be connected as human beings. We love being connected to each other, especially in the real world, in the physical space. But online, we're seeing studies back from 1998, when we first had exposure to the internet, and today, increasingly via social media, showing us that more connectivity online heightens feelings of loneliness, of depression. There's a worsening impact on physical and mental health. Our body mass index increases, you know, the more we're behind the screen. And our general life satisfaction levels decrease. So overall, it has a negative impact on our well-being. However, context is everything. It depends how you use social media, for instance, what you do on the internet, and whether you're addicted or not.
Why, if it makes us sad, why are we doing it? Does it have an addictive quality to it, Philippa?
Certainly does, because it affects the very same places in our brain, the dopamine pathways related to addictive processes, such as eating food and sexual rewards. Mm. So it's a very powerful reinforcing process, the very act of self-disclosing on social media.
Yeah, the notion of connectivity sounds great, though, doesn't it? I mean, what could possibly be wrong in combating the loneliness, the isolation that a lot of people report in living in big urban centres and, for that matter, in remote Australia and regional centres? What could be better than being more connected with people? You know, the idea once you dangle it in front of people seems almost impossible to dislike, doesn't it, Philippa?
Well, I think connectivity is great, and being able to reach out to supportive communities that are fostering your emotional health and well-being, that's fantastic. And we can build community connections and take away from isolation for people. And I guess it depends on the community too that you're connecting with. If I'm lonely and isolated and connecting with a group that may not be so healthy for me, and I don't get a variety of input from others. There can be a danger in that because I'm self-selecting what I want to be looking at and what groups I'm connecting with, because there's so many groups you can belong to on Facebook. There's communities. There's, you know, liking and status updates, regular things happening.
Yeah. In a way that doesn't really mimic what we do in actual life, does it, Katina? I know that in some ways it does. If we met and had a coffee together, you and I, if we knew each other, and, you know, I don't know, I just had some grandchildren, I probably would show you a picture of the grandchildren. So it does some things like that, but it's a bit more relentless than that, isn't it?
It is. It's hyper-connectivity. It's information overload. You know, in the real world, in the real space, we have a handful of friends that would do anything for us, you know, bring us chicken soup around the house when we're feeling down or ill, you know, check up on us physically, you know, is everything okay today? Can I help you? But in this online world, we have 1,000 followers, 1,000 friends. And how can you possibly keep up to pace with all those messages that are coming from various vectors on your phone, on your tablet device, on your Facebook account, on your Instagram account? You know, people go through this process almost every morning when they wake up. Let me check and scan every account and let me respond. But you can never really respond to everything. I find it difficult to respond and keep up with my email. And I know, you know, sometimes people catch me online sending a tweet. And this morning somebody said, you know, you haven't responded to my voicemail from yesterday and yet you're tweeting today.
I was thinking today, I was just thinking in advance of our conversation tonight, I was walking down the street on my way to the studio. There was a most magnificent moonrise, which was just outstandingly beautiful, as it sometimes can be. And I was thinking, as I was enjoying that and not doing anything else other than enjoying it, there are a lot of people today who could not look at that without feeling compelled to take a photograph and share it in a way that we never did before. And that's the difference, isn't it? This hyper-connectivity you're talking about. We're sharing and doing stuff that we didn't do before.
Yeah. It's kind of like being at the rock concert and we're videotaping it rather than actually just enjoying the experience in the moment.
Yeah.
And we're putting that online.
Have we lost the ability to be in the moment, Philippa, because of it?
Possibly.
Have we lost the ability to be alone in the moment?
That's a very clear concern, being alone. People, you're not really. So I think we have lost the ability to be alone. And that can create a great deal of anxiety for people. And therefore, they can go online and relieve that.
These studies, which, I mean, in fact, one of them's a Facebook study itself, isn't it, Katina?
It is.
One of them, in other words, it's Facebook's own study that does appear to show deterioration in mental health the more you use it.
Oh, look, our social media platform providers completely know how we're using social media, when we're using it, when we're reaching into our handbags for that phone to press a like or to comment or to look at our own statistics. You know, most people will look at themselves through their social media platforms. And the thing is, it's so closely tied with a business model that says the greater likes that I know that you are doing online and the greater comments that I can then sieve through and filter through and do sentiment analysis on, well, the better for my advertisers and for my, you know, dollar. So businesses have a vested interest in peering in what I call an open laboratory, whereby they are really critically analyzing, you know, your every move. They know you better than your mother knows you. You know, discrete likes and comments online, which happen sporadically and randomly to you, when they're analyzed through big data filter sets, actually tell you a lot about someone's personality, a lot about their response to a particular product, and how much, you know, brand leadership they might have in their opinion groups.
Why does it make us sad? What's going on there? Is it? I mean, I can understand. I've often felt this when we were discussing recently the holiday thing on Facebook, that people, when they go on holidays, feel compelled to send a whole lot of information of you having a happy time on holidays, which is great. That's terrific. Why couldn't you just have a happy time on holidays and be content with that without having to tell everybody? But I do get that some people think this constant torrent of private information that seems as though everyone's life is happier than yours, if you're not on holidays, struggling to pay the bills, at work in a job you don't like, this constant torrent of my life is better than yours is likely to make you a bit miserable, isn't it?
It's a comparison game. And really, when we think about it, you know, the grass is always greener on the other side. And what we don't realize, we are looking at curated images.
Yeah.
Nobody looks like they've got the top job, the six-figure salary, you know, the best holiday, the best food at the restaurant, the best kids that are always well-behaved, the best husband, you know, the rich car, you know, the Joneses and et cetera. We're never like that 24/7. It's fake. It's not real. And so a stream of curated messages and comments actually is not a representation of reality. Our life is hard. We have problems. We need to overcome financial barriers, a loss of a job sometimes, kids that are misbehaving, kids that are not going fantastically at school. And so when we are comparing ourselves to something that's fake, of course we're going to feel down. And Samuel Gosling said, you know, the same things that we find attractive also we find repelling. So
What do you mean by that?
Well, when people post selfies of themselves, and we're posting on average about 15 selfies per person, you know, per day.
Is that right?
Yes, and it's petabytes worth of data. I mean, just on Google servers alone, you know.
We're posting on average 15 selfies a day. That's if you look across all selfies.
That's right.
Because some people are posting many more than that.
That's right. And so we love to see things about ourselves. You know, we're never tired, we're never bored about us, about me. And maybe that's a narcissistic feel of the social
well,
media
it's true,
environment.
Isn't it? There's the old conversational gambit, isn't it, Philippa? The best way to start a conversation with someone is to say, by the way, tell me about yourself.
Yes. I actually call it social narcissism, actually.
Yes, you're right.
That's where we're caught up.
That's an interesting concept. Tell me about that.
Well, instead of narcissist, it was caught in his own reflection in the pool. We're caught in our own reflection in the screens. Time and it's very rewarding because we were able to put forth our best Photoshop picture. Or there's some great apps out there to make a picture look really terrific very quickly, and then put that out to all our people that we're connected to out there, and of course get the likes, the loves. You know, and Facebook's got little icons that make it very easy to interact very quickly.
And Philippa, I think it's also, you know, Christine Paraxis in the States talks about something called the looking glass self. It's how other people perceive us through that looking glass. And so if we don't get that game, that quantified game that says you got 50 likes for your birthday photo, you know, then there's something wrong, because the next time I post, you know, I expect another 50 likes. And if I don't get it, then maybe I'm not that good. You know, maybe I'm a failure. Maybe I'm not up to the expectations of others. And so I try to outdo myself by perhaps removing some clothing. Or perhaps, you know, putting on some makeup, or perhaps flicking my hair or looking cutesy. So this is the kind of thing, the looking glass self that Christine Paraxis talks about. And the half-life of a message now is diminishing. In 2014, it used to be 24 minutes. Last year, it went to 16 minutes. So we post
something. What do you mean by that, Katina? What's that mean?
So, you know, if you drink coffee, the half-life of a coffee, it's gone out of your system in about 4 to 5 hours.
Right.
Now we tweet or we put something on the wall, and it used to last in value. The half-life of that message used to be about 24 minutes. In just a year, it's dropped to something like 16 minutes. And in the future, it might drop
further.
What
do you mean the actual useful life of that message? That is, after 16 minutes, it's unlikely that anyone is looking
exactly
at it anymore.
So it's empathy.
Dead news.
Dead use. And
dead news.
Dead news. And
like the Trump cycle.
Like fake, not fake news, but dead news.
Dead news and empathy decay, Christine Paraxis talks about. It's our emotive response to how we think it, you know, or it should make us feel, but, you know, after it's gone, 16 minutes later, like it's short-lived.
It's fascinating, isn't it? I'm talking with Professor Katina Michael. She's from the University of Wollongong, from the School of Computing and Information Technology. We're also in the studio with us is Philippa Thornton, clinical psychologist. We're talking about whether Facebook makes you sad. Studies say it does. We're talking about why it makes you sad. And is there in the end something or anything that you could do about it? How do you tell if you're addicted anyway to it, Philippa?
Well, basically it's the amount of time, energy that you're putting into it. If it's taking away from your real life as well, if it's affecting your work relationships or your emotional status, then it could fall into that, what we call addictive category. It's not an addictive category in the DSM-5, which is psychologists diagnose. There is some thoughts that internet gaming might get up there in the next revision of that. But because it's working on those dopamine reward pathways, it does have an addictive potential. And marketers well know this. and employing things that get our attention quickly.
Amazingly, there's also the Facebook addiction scale, as you were saying, yes. Philippa, by Cecilia Andreasen at the University of Bergen in Norway, which says there are six main factors. You know, do you spend a lot of time thinking about Facebook or planning to use Facebook? Do you feel an urge to use Facebook more and more every day? Do you use Facebook to forget about your personal problems and escape? You've tried to cut down and you can't. You become restless or troubled when using Facebook is prohibited, or you use Facebook so much, as Philippa said, that you know it has a negative impact on your job, your studies, and you would know this well, Philippa, your relationships, your true world relationships, like your husband and wife, you know, and your kids. How often do we see pictures of couples in the bed with their smartphones on, not talking to each other, and just spacing out on Facebook for at least an hour a night? And if they talk, they're talking through the platform rather than physically touching. And I think one of the greatest concerns I have is that people have lost this sense of touch and this emotional connection.
Okay. In other words, yeah, that's interesting, isn't it? So in other words, we only really commit to and are spending a lot of time attending to relationships that are online rather than ones that are in front of us.
Yes.
It's pretty easy to do that. It's very convenient to just pull out your smartphone and tap in your ID code and go online, and you're in a few buttons you're in, and it's much easier to get in touch with the person in that way as opposed to in real life. I was laughing to myself as Katina was saying that, thinking, gee, I've been guilty of texting my partner in the next room.
Yeah. Oh, no, I've certainly done.
Rather than getting up and walking. Yep.
But time flies, right? When we're online, it's vague, and we go, we're only going to look at it for 2 minutes, and then 1 hour later, we're still there doing what? We don't even know. It's like going down rabbit holes. And it comes back to Philippa's point about these dopamine hits. And, you know, social psychologists are now talking about the difference of the dopamine with the opioid system in the mind, and the wanting and the searching and the anticipating, and then the reward comes. But we're getting into a dopamine endless loop, which says, I'm seeking, but I can't turn off that seek function. I can't, even though I've given you the reward. Look, you know, you've commented, you've posted the pic.
Yeah.
What's going on is we're going into this endless loop, and our brain doesn't know you're satisfied. The reward's already been given to you. Now go to sleep, and we're just going next hit, next hit, next hit. But when does it stop? It doesn't stop, and that's when we get into modes people have described of panic. They get chest pains. They're overwhelmed. There's a feeling of hopelessness. I've been sucked in. I feel lazy. I've just wasted the last 2 hours. I'm addicted. I'm angry. People describe this feeling of anger, and they might have an outburst with their family members or friends or whoever's there. And it has nothing to do with the people around them. It has everything to do with what they read. And so sad messages make you sad. There was a billion posts analyzed by the University of California, San Diego, that this researcher, Lorenzo Cavalli, said basically, we are sending some sad messages on social media platforms that are making us even sadder. And we then ripple effect through. So the positivity in our lives is gone because we're reading about sadness.
Yeah, even reading about happiness makes you sad.
Especially if you compare yourself to other
people. Well, yes, I mean, the classic, someone was pointing out to me, you know, the holiday picture with the three perfect children and in an exotic location, hashtag so blessed.
and that's
which,
called...
which, you know, can make people really miserable.
And envious.
Yeah.
That's called affective forecasting error. Affect from the emotion, the feelingness.
Yeah.
We forecast that if we get onto social media, it's like an antidepressant. But sadly what happens, we get onto social media, it has the opposite effect to an antidepressant. And it's affective forecasting error. It's our mistake. We think we're going online for a fix, a good thing, a positive thing. And why do we just go, oh, that was a letdown?
My impression is, just to return to the point you're making earlier, Katina, my impression is that generally when spending time with people these days, people feel as though it's at least as important that they attend to their messages on their smartphone, whether they be Facebook or something else. They feel it's at least as important that they attend to those. And it has at least as equal importance, sometimes more, than talking to you if you're actually in their presence. People feel that it's okay to pull out a phone and say, look, I've just got to deal with these things here.
In a way that would never,
that's a new behavior pattern though for us, isn't it? Because normally if we're to in the presence of someone, we attend to them until we, you know, the interaction ends.
Mm-hmm.
That's not the case anymore.
No, it's instantaneous interruption, and that ping, that notification on your phone, seems more important than actually getting the kids their lunch or doing homework with the children. So this has happened to all of us at one stage or another, where we're engaged, engrossed, and we just think, I just need one more line. I need 5 minutes. Give me 5 minutes and I'll send this email. And the kids are going, but Mum, I'm hungry. Yeah. You know, I need to get to the sport venue. You know, when are you coming? Hurry up, you're late. And then we just keep going.
We're talking whether Facebook makes you sad tonight. There's studies that show that it does. And I think, my guest, Professor Katina Michael, was telling us earlier that the half-life of a message on social media has declined from something like 24 minutes not so long ago to about 16 minutes now. In other words, we are scrolling faster and faster. That whole scrolling approach to the information that we've got now is partly in response to how much of it there is, isn't there, Katina?
Sure is. I mean, it's overload. We can't get through all of it, and it panics some people that they can't get through everything.
Yeah.
I know people that are literally not leaving their houses unless they've gone through the top 10 YouTube downloads for the night. And if I can't watch them so I can't talk about them with friends, then I can't leave. It cripples them, literally. Wow.
Are we in a new era in our history, Philippa, do you think? Or are these old patterns coping with new technologies?
Yeah, I think there is what you're saying. There's something to that, Phil. It's like social media, our smartphones are like the rock and roll, the TV age that we're having to adapt to. And really quickly, though, because our brains don't develop that quickly in response. They take thousands of years, in fact. But we are, so caught up in this net, really.
Yes, the whole news cycle gets faster and faster and faster. But, of course, in terms of processing emotions, I think there was a law, wasn't there, that we can't actually deal with any more than about, I forget, but there's a limit as to how many people we can actually deal with in terms of have an interest in, pay any possible attention to, and also remember their names.
That's right.
And it's not more than 100. I don't think it may be even substantially less. Whereas, of course, that's not what's going on social media either, is there?
No, you have thousands of people that are followers and people you haven't met in the real world, of friends, and, you know, there's 6 degrees of separation. Oh, I know that person. I've got this many people following me. And it's. I think you're alluding to triggers. And triggers have been around through the study of obsessive compulsive disorder, for instance, through various diagnosed diseases. And what I think we have here is a new set of mental health issues that we've not really named yet. Just like in the 70s, you know, we had fast food coming onto the scene, and now we know fast food causes obesity. I think it's not going to take too long before we realize that excessive use online actually is X. And these studies, you know, we're finding this research in things that are talking about the fact that we're not moving as much, and that's causing obesity in itself. It's causing brain drain. It's causing relationship and loneliness issues. And so these things need to be further investigated by social psychologists in particular.
Yeah, just back to connectivity, Philippa. In other words, is it a bit like the lonely in a crowd syndrome, that the more connected we are, the more disconnected a lot of people feel?
Exactly. You can be putting a lot out there and connecting a lot, but I think there's an emptiness, people that are actually on social media a lot are displaying, because that's a virtual world, not the real world.
Yeah.
So there is an emptiness or a space there that's not being met, a need for intimacy, closeness, connection, real connection. I'm talking about life world, not the virtual world.
I mean, I was interested in your use of the word touch earlier, Katina, because it's a profoundly important human thing, of course. Not just sexual touch, of course, but touch of all kinds. In a sense, that doesn't happen in this space at all, does it?
No, there's an authenticity that's missing. You know, when you tell somebody online, "I love you," you probably mean it. How many people have met online that have got these amazing stories of marriages, you know, that have been enacted, or partnerships, you know, friendships, deep, deep friendships that have been sparked from the days of the bulletin board? You know, I don't negate that at all. But equal response to that is, how many people have been tempted And those triggers are there forever, all day, 24/7. And I think that comes back to the curiosity, the dopamine fix, the searching. And touch is such a physical thing. You don't have that physicality yet on the net. I mean, we have these emerging technologies that are going to increase sense of smell reaction online, a sense of touch, you know, remote wearables, for instance. And there's a lot of things that are happening in that adult-only space, which I won't go into on this program, but they are trying to replicate that touch feeling remotely between partners, for instance. But I'm going to argue something. There is nothing like being with someone in a room, looking at their eyes and saying, I love you, or touching someone and just holding their hand, squeezing their hand and saying, you know, you mean everything to me. And that's what we're missing. That's why we're together but alone, as Sherry Turkle says. You know, we're together but we're feeling alone, and we're confessing online instead of reflecting that inward space, that private space that was there for us to make mistakes, perhaps think things that we were free to think. We're now externalizing and blurting out online, and the internet is unforgiving. You know, we can delete our messages later, but when people confess online their uttermost secrets, thinking nobody else can read this and figure out, oops, my privacy settings are not set on the, you know, clothes, they're been broadcasted to the world to read, then we're almost confessing to a computer, and we think somebody's on the other side listening, but nothing's listening except the companies running the platform and selling you advertising gear.
Yeah, which is another matter, of course, entirely. Barbara, you've had a different experience. Hello, welcome to Nightlife.
Oh, hello. Yes, I had quite serious clinical depression, and I'd shut myself off from everything, and I couldn't connect with anybody. And it was through a member of the family putting me onto Facebook and so on that actually helped me break out of it, and I started to connect, and I'm quite well now. And so, in fact, it was a significant aspect of my getting well.
Who did you connect with, Barbara, can I ask?
Members of family, but also strangers. But, you know, I was careful. I didn't friend everybody and so on. But it was very helpful. And I found even now, if I have a day that I'm feeling down, I can get on that and it... and I can face the world again.
Okay. All right.
And so what you were sort of saying about it making people depressed, I think, if anything, it was a tool to get me well.
Yeah. Yeah, okay. All right. What's going on there, Philippa? I mean, we're not obviously saying that Facebook is bad for everybody. And these, of course, these studies are studies across the mass of population. So it's not necessarily true for everybody in every circumstance. Of course not. But in Barbara's case...
Oh, it's wonderful, Barbara, that you're feeling much better, and Facebook offered you that connection, emotional connection by the sounds, to people close to you, and that's helped bring you out of that depression. That's wonderful. I'm thinking, Phil, it's actually our adolescents, our younger folk, that are really struggling more with being caught up.
Do they use it differently, do you think, than adults?
A far greater deal than...
Oh, I know they're using it more, but do they use it differently?
It's a way of communicating moment to moment, and so there's a higher level of interconnection. And, of course, we've got that peer social group that's so important for young people, and how to fit in and their need for approval. So, of course, they're going to be and there's problems, of course, with cyberbullying, cyberstalking, and the group mentality. Because that can happen on mediums such as Facebook and Twitter. And you've seen people have actually suicided in relation to bullying, trolling.
Yeah, no, they have too. But as, well, I think a lot of people are keen to stress, not everybody. Luca, hello.
Oh, hello, Phil. How are you, mate?
Yeah, well, thanks.
So look, what I was going to say is I don't really think the sole blame can be thrown onto social media. I think, and also I don't know who exactly was surveyed or, you know, what people are saying that social media is increasing depression. But look, I'd just say that perhaps social media, and all the how connected we all are, and just we receive information a lot quicker. It makes the world feel smaller, and it makes the problems feel closer, and it makes everything sort of seem like it's going to affect you more. Also, Facebook, you choose what you want to see on there. You choose. Nothing that you don't want to see, apart from possibly advertisements, you won't see because mm-hmm. you pick what shows up on your news feed.
How hard is that to do, Luca? Because I can imagine most people would say, I don't want to restrict it particularly because I don't know what I'll be missing out on.
Yeah, that's a fair point. I mean, I've just literally walked away from my computer. I was like on Facebook, just looking at it. But I don't really get too worried about likes and dislikes and things like that. But I just think that, honestly, I just don't think that, like, life gets hard. I mean, I'm 28, and I've just been slowly getting more depressed since I probably turned 21.
Mm-hmm.
It's just normal because more things happen. More stress happens, more stuff gets piled
why
on.
Why do you think it's normal, Luca? Is that the experience of others around you?
Well, possibly not, but, I mean, I've got many friends that use a lot more Facebook than me, who other people, outsiders, might look at us both and say that maybe they're doing better socially, you know, wife, kids, things like that. I don't have any of that. I'm still single.
Hmm.
Yeah, I mean, it's just, it's very personal, very personal, you know, and it's so personal that I don't think you can just umbrella it. Oh, social media, that's the problem, because it's so personal that someone could get upset about, you know, nothing or almost nothing.
Mm.
Just a fly offhand comment is really going to affect some people, and then other people, you know, will not affect at all. But then you could say something else that will affect those people and then not affect, you know, it's just so broad. Everyone's so different that I don't know how you can just say social media, we're too obsessed with social media, we're getting depressed from the likes and the lack of likes.
Yeah, no, I'm not. I suppose we're saying something else here, Luca, that is that if this huge technology is actually causing significant mental health issues, then we need to know about that and to think about it. About what we do, in the same way that we think about fast food and its effect.
Yeah, I mean, I can see what you're saying there, but yeah, I mean, look, at the same time, okay, maybe it's a little bit because of how I am,
sure,
and obviously that's the only point of view I get. I don't get anyone else's, and none of us do. You know, we don't get. Any sense of what anyone else is thinking or what's going to upset them or what's not going to upset them or, you know, what's going to affect them. We've only got ourselves to judge. That's the only compass we've got is our own. So I just don't think that you can, it just seems a bit too broad.
Yeah, okay.
I think that someone, if someone's mentally unstable enough to get suicidal or depressed over a lack of likes or feeling like they're missing out online, I just think that the problem's deeper than social media. I just don't think, I mean, it's just a new technology. People are getting depressed since the cavemen. You know? So yeah, life's hard. We get sad sometimes. We get happy sometimes. That's it.
There's not enough brontosauruses around here. Yeah. Yeah, thanks, Luca. That's interesting.
No, not a problem, mate. Thanks for hearing from me.
Yeah, no, thoughtful contribution too.
Perhaps it's even in the way that people who are down, I mean, we use depressed a lot, but a lot of people aren't clinically depressed.
No.
People are a bit sad and low mood or feeling stressed. There's a big difference in that. But perhaps people who are sad tend to, as we know, compare themselves unfavorably to other people. They tend to take a negative worldview, feel a sense of hopelessness and helplessness. They don't feel in control of themselves. Social media will kind of amplify those feelings by putting them in your face.
Katina, do you think people oversell themselves on Facebook? And that in itself causes the anxiety. Because, I mean, the age-old thing, if only people really knew about me, they wouldn't think that I was that good because I'm not. And in other words, on Facebook, your presence on Facebook is oversold. You oversell yourself.
And if it's not overselling, it's the most curated version of you, you know, the best photos, not the photos of when you're looking the worst. And so there's a fabrication element to it. So if it's not overselling, it's fabricated or it's curated. It's an online space. I mean, there's a lot of online reputation management that young adolescents are talking about not wanting to do, but having to do. But to Luca's point, I mean, I'm quoting studies like the Harvard Business Review, American Journal of Epidemiology, the University of California, San Diego, Yale University, the Human Nature Lab, the Review of General Psychology, you know, University of College Dublin, the HomeNet study, University of Copenhagen,
There's a body of that's the reason we started with the program.
That's
tonight.
Right.
There is a body of credible in research, isn't there, which does show this.
And they're saying all of these. If you have mild depression, don't step on that Facebook platform unless as directed by carers or loved ones or in a way that you're aware, because most likely these studies are saying you will increase your levels of depression. And especially if you then have bipolar or you have something like schizophrenia, you're actually not sure. And I'm not selling any of these individuals short. Their maturity and their awareness is more heightened than the rest of us at times. But I would just be just careful of being stalked, potentially of being trolled. And these are very well-defined games that people play online. You know, you get a comment. And to me, perhaps Luke is 100% right. I don't care. You know, I'm an academic. It doesn't matter what people say. I've gotten a maturity level that says I won't be impacted by that response. However, someone who hasn't got that awareness and gets a vile comment back, bagging them about how they look, about what they've said, about what they've achieved, that actually would hurt them deeply.
Philippa?
Well, I was thinking of celebrities, actually. They have to take in a lot of comments and horrible situations that do take a toll, because it's if you say and repeat something often enough, which is brainwashing, that becomes a message that you will take in. Even with a lot of maturity, it's hard not to believe it.
Well, look at Ed Sheeran. He said, just get off.
That'll be easy. I was just looking at a Missouri study, though, from Nathan Hurst in 2015. They used an article that said, if Facebook causes envy, depression could follow. What they found was that it was the way Facebook was used that was tied into depression. They found that what they called surveillance use of social media.
What's that mean?
That's where people checked up on how their friends were doing and compared what they saw to their own lives. And this tended to produce feelings of depression because they'll negatively compare themselves. And they often sized up their accomplishments against other people's, again, on the negative side, producing an envy that, you know, the vacations, those glorious vacations, those nice houses, cars, relationships.
Meals.
Food.
Where'd the meals thing come from?
They just couldn't match up to their friends. They were always on the downside of that equation. And, you know, even though they probably rationally we know that, but we're emotional creatures. We are driven
Amazing.
By the emotional brain.
Philip, you said, where did those food, you know, pictures come from? C.S. Lewis was writing about, you know, the world's going to go absolutely nuts if we ever, you know, take photographs of our food and like sexually fall in love with it, you know. And it
That's
has happened.
It's happened.
It's happened. His predictions come true, you know. His worst nightmare happened.
Oh, dear. Professor Katina Michaels with us from the University of Wollongong and Philippa Thorne, a clinical psychologist. We're talking about whether Facebook makes you sad. There's a lot of research which suggests it does. How else might you use it and what else might we do about it? And what are some guidelines? We'll talk about that too. And look, I buy what a lot of people are telling me online and in conversations too here, that not everything, of course, it's not if you use social media you get sad. But is there something about this technology across the platform generally and its impact on the community in generally, which is not always positive? Because after all, I suppose, Katina, we were told by Mark Zuckerberg when he invented the thing at Harvard, which it started out, of course, as just it was called the Facebook. It was a little piece of smarts by him where he actually did manage to do a clever thing, which was to aggregate headshot photographs and invent a way for people to compare and comment upon those photographs, that it was connecting people. But having given us that, what we see on Facebook now is not about connecting. Well, it is about connecting people, but it's not about connecting people for the purposes of them getting to know each other. It's about connecting people so that we know more about you, because at least since Facebook took themselves public, it's about connecting people for the purposes of selling you things or selling things to advertisers. I don't want to get into the evils or otherwise of that. I mean, that's what large corporations do, but That's also a fact, though, isn't it? That the connectivity that Facebook are talking about is connectivity these days, which is designed to sell you things.
I think all good and well for a business wanting to, you know, help their shareholders and help themselves. I do question why Zuckerberg, you know, removed his personal profile in full and his own family that were part of the company.
They're not on there anymore.
No, they're not. Dot and so forth. And Dot's actually written a book about Facebook, which has been a bit damning. But the question, I think, is how many people are aware that this is happening? How many people are aware that, for instance, law enforcement, you know, Facebook is their first one-stop shop. It's the cheapest, it's free, and they have access, and they do a lot of image comparisons. So the average person might not know how it's being used for law enforcement purposes, but also for behavioral advertising and targeted advertising right down to the micro level. And we run different kinds of algorithms on people's personalities based on how often they check Facebook, how long they're on Facebook, what they like, what they dislike, and what kinds of images. You know, there are these algorithms now that trawl through and do image analysis based on the pictures. You know, have you got hundreds or thousands of baby photos up there? Okay, I'll sell you baby food, or I'll sell you, you know, baby clothes online. And so what we don't realize is that it's a conduit now for advertising and purchasing. And one of the other addictions is, you know, we talk about Facebook addiction and gaming addiction, perhaps online pornography addiction, which is a very well-known established thing for relationship counsellors.
Well, there's been an explosion on that, hasn't there? I mean,
it's so accessible.
Yeah.
It's sexually explicit material online. It's a click.
Yeah.
Mm, I had a client that actually
lost
his
job. Is that
a good
or bad thing, do you think?
It's not my personal preference, but obviously
but apart from that,
it's huge that people can. I think parents, especially, need to be really vigilant in what children can access, because in one click you're at a very explicit location. Try doing some research when you're a researcher. Hey, Katina, yes. Pornography and what's in your face already? Mm. It's scary, and it has addictive properties, and it's very reinforcing. I mean, sex is itself.
Let's get back to some calls. Lloyd, hello. Hi, Lloyd. G'day, Lloyd. You there with us? Lloyd, hello.
Yes.
Sorry about that. My problem. Where you go?
Yeah. I'm a non-user, you know, of technology. Probably my education, lack of it, and age and that, but you know, my family does, and and my daughter does, and I've always been there, say, no, don't put us on your Facebook, you want to use it for your lot.
Does she put you on there, Lloyd?
Yeah, yes and no, I don't know, because I don't get on there, but it's actually driven a wedge between us. So
really?
It's
why is that? Thing.
Oh, well, it's personal things that you know, have happened in the family, and
that she's talking about on Facebook.
Well, yeah, and I don't want her to. Yeah, and, well, she's not actually. Well, I don't know if she is or not, but you know, we have an argument every time we talk about it. And she says, no, Facebook is good, you know, and all this sort of thing. But,
so, Lloyd, I was talking to an older gentleman just this afternoon about the program, and a similar situation in his context, and his daughter-in-law refuses to post anything to him other than in Facebook or Instagram, and he doesn't use either of these platforms, and so he's been locked out from his children's development, grandchildren's development, and now they've moved to Europe. So the question is, he's been withheld important information to him for the development of his family and his extended family, and he feels very sad about that.
Yeah, I can understand that totally. But, I mean, it's probably partly my fault, because I don't want to keep up with technology, and I should trust her a lot more, sort of thing. But at the end of the day, is personal life is your personal life, and certain things that you don't want to be on there, because once it's on there, it's there forever and for anyone to know about. And they just
You got any advice for him?
Well, Lloyd, you do sound like, I can hear that privacy is very important to you, and it sounds to me like that's what your issue is with your daughter. What is the issue that she's posting stuff on the internet that, or, you know, on Facebook, or that you don't like? Or
I'm not, well, I don't know, because I don't get on the internet, but every time I talk to her about it, and she says the internet's all right and all that sort of thing, and you know, it's, you know.
So it sounds to me like you have a difference of opinion there. She thinks the internet's good.
That's right. Yeah.
Okay. But is that all you're on? I feel sad that you're not able to connect with your daughter in other ways.
Yeah. Well, it's a lot to do. You know, things that happen in the family and things should be kept in family and
all right. Good luck with it, Lloyd. Thanks for sharing it with us. Appreciate it. Yeah. Katina, yeah.
Yes, we ran a study with Heather Kennedy Eden a couple of years ago and showed that families that were dysfunctional offline, the technology layer just increased that dysfunctionality if it was already dysfunctional. Mm-hmm. And so people wouldn't return voicemails, wouldn't return Facebook, you know, wall posts, and just were devoid of that connection. But I do feel for the people who have opted out from Facebook and their younger friends, for instance, adolescents or teenagers or university students, won't get invited to parties because people say, well, if you're not on Facebook, I can't be bothered to send you an email. That's old school. And so you're excluded. And this happens all the time.
Yeah. Mm. My texter says, Kim from Stanmore Park says, sorry, not Kim. Social media checking was affecting my productivity at work for some months. Mm. I've given my partner my password and I've been off Facebook for the last week. I do feel calmer and better almost instantly. How should we look, we've got, you know, 3 or 4 minutes left in the program. What's a better way to approach it? I mean, it's a big ubiquitous technology. It's hard to ignore completely. What's a better way to do it, Philippa?
Well, you need to talk to your partner, and it's great that you have shared your password because it can cause real problems if people start relationships in virtually online that can lead to real world lives. So set some limits together. Talk openly, share openly. I think it's great that you know each other's password. That needs to be a given, and negotiate what's acceptable use and some limits around that. Perhaps there isn't any phones in the bed, any media items, or at dinner time, those sorts of things.
What do you think, Katina? What's a better way for us to go forward on this?
I think having a Facebook account is not the problem. It's the amount of use, and so decrease the frequency and the length of time you have online. I'd say declare a period of time during a day, during the week, where you're completely offline. Have limits, as Philippa said, so maybe switch off notifications or switch off devices after 10 o'clock in the evening and just say, you know, I can go to sleep without worrying about it. Get a real alarm clock. Don't use your phone as an alarm clock because then it stops you from reaching over when you can't go back to sleep in the middle of the night. Don't use Facebook on your phone if you don't have to. Just use it on your desktop. And it just basically stops you from going in and looking for messages and getting that hit. Replace those online activities with offline activities. Go for a walk, you know, walk the dog, meditate, pray, do other things, cook, learn to cook, do things with your kids like homework. Be active with real people around you in the workplace, at home, and health. You know what? You go for a walk for an hour. You know, you can take your phone to listen to music if you want, but don't look up on that web page or that email while you're walking. And I'm telling you, do this enough times in a month and you're going to love it so much that you're going to think, forget it, I'd rather be doing this and go out to nature than sitting indoors, getting text neck and sitting on that couch going, I'm only going to answer one email, and then 5 hours later you're still there cramped up on that little iPhone trying to communicate with others. So it's leave it alone and actively look for real connections in the real world with people around you.
Good advice. All right. I hope we've sparked some thoughts for you. Professor Katina Michael has been our guest from the School of Computing and Information Technology at the University of Wollongong. Katina, terrific to have you in.
Thank you for the invitation.
Passion. Thank you for your passionate views too. And Philippa Thornton, a psychologist, not clinical, who's joined us as well. My mistake. I'm sorry about that. Philippa, terrific to have your insights as well.
Thank you.
You've been listening to a Nightlife podcast. For more great conversations about the issues that impact you, as well as features on travel and food, head to the Nightlife webpage. You'll find it at abc.net.au/nightlife.
You don't need to be a night owl to enjoy the nightlife.